Hi, this is Erin Free Smith with the New Books Network Africa Channel. Today we are with George Paul Mayu. He has written a fantastic book entitled Ethnoerotic Economies, Sexuality, Money, and Belonging in Kenya. It was published by the University of Chicago Press in 2017. Welcome, George.
Thank you for having me, Erin.
Yeah, thank you for coming. So let's jump right in. So how did you get your start in this topic?
I'm an anthropologist. I'm an assistant professor of anthropology and African-American studies at Harvard University. So I teach classes on Africa, sexuality, gender, kinship and citizenship, ethnographic methods. So much of what this book is actually about comes from a long-term engagement with some of these topics, but also some of my personal interests in anthropology. I am originally from Romania. My parents and I immigrated to Canada just after I finished high school. I actually had started college in Romania at University of Transylvania. And that's where I became interested in anthropology. As a kid, actually, growing up or spending much of my time in my father's village, where there was this culture of post-socialist kind of ethnography, where whole groups of people would go and study a village. And I came to anthropology basically because while I was 12 or 13, anthropologists were studying the village where my father was from, and they were interviewing my grandmother and so on. So a lot of what materialized basically in this project is the product of a long-standing engagement with anthropology and with particular sets of topics within it.
That is absolutely fascinating. Particularly, that is a big critique of outside scholars going into Africa, particularly anthropologists, sort of coming in as the outsider and studying them as subjects rather than as people. But you already have that experience. That's really fascinating.
Right. I did grow up with anthropologists in my village, as it were, and I was constantly aware of that as I was working in villages in Samburu in northern Kenya myself. Actually, sometimes with young men who had BA degrees in anthropology, Samburu young men who had BAs in anthropology. So there is a growing interest, actually, even in my field site now, in anthropology and its possibilities, especially in relation to development, politics, questions of land, and so on.
Right, and the ways in which anthropology can inform people's like agency within those rural districts, or in what way?
Absolutely, but also in terms of how can you imagine a future in a context in which people like Samburu have long been marginalized within the nation state, economically and politically, that is. And now, in the past few years, there's been an uprise of new kinds of possibilities, partially because the Kenyan state has been reconfigured, a new constitution has been written, a power has been decentralized, as it were. And Samburu, that has long been a marginal area, now it's venturing in all kinds of forms of capital with tourism, safari tourism, all kinds of enterprises and so on. So that kind of, interestingly, some of the people I know with higher education in social sciences are actually very much involved in the world of NGOs and the new politics of the county, the Samburu County, to imagine new kinds of collective futures.
Right. That's interesting. And so how did you arrive at Africa, but more specifically Kenya, for your region of study?
Yeah, I was an undergraduate student at Concordia University in Montreal, and I had a professor, Andre Vasca, who grew up in Kenya and who whose courses I took. And that's how I became very much interested in Kenya per se. What took me to Kenya were topics that basically have little to do with the current book, though they're not absent from it. One was, of course, tourism, which is still very much there. I was interested in what tourism does to various places and various communities. The other topic was cattle. I grew up in a village that basically depended on cattle economies in part. So I was very much interested in cattle economies as an undergraduate student. Certainly, this has little to do with the outcome of the book. I came upon mm-hmm. the subject of my book in 2005 when I was doing preliminary research in the area. And I went there interested in tourism and cattle, but not really knowing what I was doing. And at that point, my informants were talking extensively about relationships between women from Western European countries and Samburu men. Young Samburu men. What was basically happening was that since the 1980s, Samburu men were migrating to the coast, to the Indian Ocean, to Mombasa and other coastal cities. And they were dancing for tourists, selling souvenirs, but most of the time hoping to actually meet European women for one-night stands or for long-term, long-distance relationships, oftentimes also marriages. And these kinds of relationships circulated miraculous kind of wealth. In Samburu villages up north, we're talking about a very large distances, 600 miles between the coast and the homeland of the homes of these men in northern Kenya. And you can imagine villages with mud houses or houses made of wooden poles and iron sheet roofs. And suddenly in that kind of landscape, you have villas with three stories materialize, mm-hmm. Land Rovers parked in front of their gates. So this kind of miraculous wealth became suddenly so visible. And when I arrived for the first time in Maralal, and which is the headquarters of Samburu County and the surroundings, that was the kind of topic that interested people a lot. One of the many topics, of course, but there seemed to be a lot of gossip, a lot of rumor about this kind of wealth that materialized miraculously in their landscape, and trying to understand how this wealth is being associated with sexuality. Why has sex become a source of money and wealth? Is it a legitimate source of money and wealth? Would that kind of wealth last, or would it dissipate as quickly as it arrived? So these kinds of topics were central, as well as trying to figure out who these men really are and what they're trying to do with their wealth. Are they trying to belong to local kinship groups, to clans and lineages, to their age grades and age sets? Some of these topics that were long studied by an older generation of anthropologists, but that suddenly became so important, again, as principles for defining belonging locally in a context in which Samburu collectively sought new ways to rearticulate their relationships, their relationship to the state, the market, and to each other.
Right. And how were you able to gain the trust of these people and able to sort of break down that barrier between the foreigner trying to come in and look at their lives?
Certainly we have better relationships with some people. We get to know other people less, but it's always through particular kinds of friendships, I think, that we come to learn as anthropologists what we do. I spent a lot of time trying to learn the languages. I speak Swahili fluently. I'm quite advanced in Ma, Samburu Ma language, both of which were quite important in doing fieldwork. But I also spent all my summers there since 2005, pretty much, as well as long-term fieldwork for a year and a half at some point. And throughout these years, of course, I got to know certain families. I worked in a with several villages, but two of which I cover most of all in the book are my the places where I spend most of the time in. So it is through building those kinds of relationships that I think this learning process could start.
Right. But in addition to maintaining those relationships, you also were publishing in this time as well about your findings, were you not? Was it difficult to, did you need to hide your findings in order to keep people open, or how were you able to negotiate that?
Look, sexuality, I think, is a very controversial topic in Kenya nowadays. But yes. Oftentimes I found that I certainly did not have to hide the fact that I was studying sexuality, and most people were very open to talk to me about these kinds of problems, partially because, as I said before, they were trying to understand how sexuality figures in their own lives. Since colonialism, Samburu and Maasai and other East African ethnic groups have been sexualized by colonial discourse, by developmental discourse. HIV prevention discourse is yet another place where certain ethnic groups have been othered and sexualized in problematic kinds of ways. Many of my interlocutors were aware of living with this kind of alterity in their lives and trying to imagine lives through and around that kind of sexual alterity. So in a way, they were very much interested in figuring out how adultery figures in everyday life, how questions of incest, how transactional sex figures, and how one might imagine a future by putting this in the right place. So in that sense, I did not have to hide anything. These were questions mm-hmm. that were openly discussed. Though, of course, I did feel that oftentimes in conversations with middle-class Kenyans, mostly in Nairobi, in the capital city, or Mombasa, the topic of my research was considered vulgar. Potentially sure. An embarrassment to Kenya. Certainly this was not the opinion of the men and women in Samburu I worked with. And what I tried to do also was to have some of my informants and research assistants read what I write. It works very well, I think, for receiving certain kind of feedback and adding detail to my findings and so on. So that's something I've been trying to work with.
Okay. And I found that the diverse range of actors in this book was quite astounding. It really felt as though you looked at it from a myriad of points of view. One set that I was very interested in, which you did go into detail on, were these European women.
Right.
Now, initially, how do you think that this group of women have changed? Because this has been going on for a long time, and it seems as though there's people who are actively encouraging this form of economy,
right.
Both the tourism industry and the people at the beach. So how did these women sort of shift over the time?
That's an interesting question. One thing I was trying to do actually was, just to respond first to the first part of your question, was to resist any attempt to narrow this project down on a set of predetermined tourist sites where tourists and guests meet, which is pretty much what the anthropology of tourism has been doing in a way. So thinking of the tourist site as the field site, your anthropological village, as it were, and try to map the dynamics within those sites. I try to break away from that and look at the kinds of exchanges that happen between Samburu areas, coastal tourism, and to some extent Europe, although for this book, I didn't do any field research in Europe, but I did work with the European women you mentioned. Most of the women that I worked with, European women, some of which were just in Kenya for their vacations on the coast. Many others purchased land and built houses up north in Samburu, trying to follow their partners to their home communities. Some moved there permanently, few of them though. Many others would come and visit them every summer and so on. But there was a certain kind of investment in Samburu, in their partners' relationships with their kin groups, lineages, and so on. And for many of them, that was a way to not only build effective kinship, but also to reinvent themselves, to think themselves in different kinds of ways. Now, to speak more specifically to the question of how this has changed over time, it's hard to tell because certainly we're talking about most of the time about more senior women. Since the 1980s already, it was more senior women who would move. We're talking about lower to upper middle class women in Germany, England, the Netherlands, France, some of the Scandinavian countries as well. Were you asking me in terms of a specific demographic or also in terms of kind of shifting desires, perhaps?
No, I think that, I mean, it looks as though it creating roots in Kenya adds validity to the relationship.
Right.
So, I mean, how were these women seen? I mean, are they seen as, you know, these cougars who are there to extract virility and masculinity, or are they seen as actual partners? Mm-hmm.
This is, it's the ambivalence, I think, that is most powerful here, because on the one hand, and this is why I'm actually resisting any kind of classification throughout the book of referring to my interlocutors as romance tourists or sex tourists or any of that sort, because those kinds of labels basically show very little. Indeed, many of the women that I worked with were interested to dissociate themselves very consciously from those kinds of labels. They were trying to dissociate themselves from the tourist site and move into Samburu communities, thus producing something potentially more authentic. So certainly that kind of move outside the tourist resorts, I'm not sure if that's new per se, but it's an important act of self-making. So I'm writing about, for example, how building homes becomes a very important act realm of self-making for some of the European women that I worked with. A woman who came from Britain and lived in Kenya for the past 25 years was constantly engaged in a project of building a house, decorating it, and so on. She was wealthier than other women I worked. And once she built a new house, she would sell the old one, move into the new one, and so on. So that kind of labor of building and designing and so on I see as very much about self-making. Another woman from Germany who was living in a mud house in a Samburu village with her partner and was certainly not as wealthy as others, constantly spent time purchasing fabrics, small kind of furniture that would fit in her house, and trying to imagine this kind of space of romance and family. So those kinds of ideas were certainly very important, as well as trying to constantly reflect. This was an important theme about the role of money in their own intimacies. So many of the women I worked with were preoccupied with the extent to which their Samburu families or partners should or should not demand money from them, how much money they could ask for, or before the relationship was no longer one based on love, but rather one based on monetary transactions. And this, of course, has been a long-standing topic in both anthropology and social theory. Thinking just of Vivian Zelizer's work about the constant Euro-American preoccupation with telling the limits between money and authentic love, and so on. But certainly, what we know from the from African studies and studies on love and intimacy in African contexts are that these kinds of realms are not as separate. To get back to your question about how the women were seen, here a certain kind of ambivalence is very important. On the one hand, the age difference between the women and their younger male partners was an object of ridicule in gossip, everyday gossip, but also in some of the Samburu folk songs that I recorded, and an issue of a certain kind of moral anxiety, because what those kinds of relationships brought out in the open in Samburu was the fact that similar relationships actually existed in Samburu villages between young men and the wives of elders. Adulterous relationships that, while everybody knew that they existed, had to be kept secret. They had to be hidden, as it were, from public view. So that kind of like publicizing of a intergenerational relationship was often found very problematic. Men and women also found problematic the fact that many of these relationships would not result in offspring, and therefore in the growth of the lineage. And that notion of growth I'm writing about is quite important in understanding where social value is located, and quite normative, to be sure. Mm-hmm. So the absence of children was certainly a problem at times. But at the same time, their very affectionate ways of referring to the white woman in the Samburu lineage as our Muzungu, our white woman, or our white person, or our daughter, or and in a way, there was a certain kind of fetishization of whiteness there as well, that the white woman could be the person to provide, to help in this kind of growing process of the lineage by making certain kind of resources available.
So they're creating the economy for social development, but not creating that the children to create the lineage. Right. Was it possible for a man to take several wives if he had a white woman?
Many did, actually. Precisely because they had a white woman and had more access to more money, as it were, than other men. So one issue was bride wealth. And for the past few decades, less and less men, I argue, have been able to pay bride wealth. What has been happening for the past 10, 15 years is that bride wealth debts become the rule, as opposed to actual bride wealth cattle or money. That is to say, the promise that one day when I will have money, I will be paying the bride wealth. And what these men were able to do is that because of access to money through their white partners, they would pay upfront bride wealth for one or two wives. Oftentimes, way before they would be allowed in terms of age set rules to marry. And suddenly you had young men in their early 20s becoming polygamous elders, precisely because they could afford to pay that bride wealth. Now, whether or not their European partners knew about these marriages is a whole different story. One French woman who was my longstanding informant was okay to find out that her partner, her husband, also married a second wife, a Samburu woman, arguing, playing a certain kind of popular cultural relativism and saying that since I married in his culture, I have to respect his culture. But many women were not okay about that. So oftentimes some of the threats that emerge in villages as a form of revenge against young men who, because they're so wealthy, are also arrogant, is to threaten them to inform their European partners of all the other marriages they have been contracting.
Right. And there was one instance in your book where a white woman actually took the former husband or the current husband to court, to the traditional court?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, yes. It's not a traditional court. It was to the county court to get back the wealth that that she had spent in Samburu and actually had put on his name. Yeah.
Right. So we're sort of speaking right now about more successful stories about the men who are able to go, return, and have some sort of higher status through this wealth.
Right.
But what are the stories of failure? I mean, what was the success rate for men going to the beach areas and returning home with wealth?
So that is a very important question, because at the same time that some of the richest men in Samburu that I met basically during the years I was there were men in relationships with European women, some of the poorest were also men who actually spent many years on the coast trying to find European partners without any kind of success. And in the process, because coastal cities are so much more expensive than life in Samburu, not being able to return with any substantial savings. I do think that the ones who, so to say, quote unquote, failed in this process were many more than those who actually succeeded. And I'll talk a bit about the conundrums of their lives in a second. But I also think that those who did succeed became highly visible precisely because of the visibility of their wealth, therefore animating all kinds of desires to go to the coast and engage in this kind of speculative economy of self-making and ethno-eroticization to potentially get to that kind of wealth. And this is a small window that we're talking about here too. Aging becomes a depleting process for young men, as for young women in any kind of sexual economy, so that one can only spend so many years in a sexual economy and still have a chance to encounter a European partner and come into this kind of wealth, as it were. So many of the men who aged on the coast without acquiring any wealth came to be known in Samburu as beach boy elders. In Ma, it's Payenilo beach boy, which is kind of a disrespectful way to refer to an elder, a way to infantilize him, but also the notion of the beach boy as a certain kind of perverted masculinity is an important way to think about them. And many of these men who returned, well, some of them never return. A few of them that I know stay on the coast because they do not have a family. They do not have anything to subsist on in Samburu. But many others do come back. And when they do, they become very invested in the ritual politics of the Samburu County. A ritual has long been a prerogative of elders, male and female elders, and a place nowadays where you can seek some sort of empowerment, because so many of these wealthy young men do need the blessings of elders if they want to contract marriages ahead of time, ahead of their legitimate age set time, as it were, because so many politicians actually seek different kind of ritual blessings from elders. Ritual itself is more and more inflected with a commodity value. So some of the so-called beach boy elders who return home without any wealth suddenly become very invested in the ritual economies of their own villages, their own clans, and seek new ways to assert their belonging to the region and to seek some sort of respectability in their home communities.
And could that be seen as punitive, or is that just utilizing a more traditional means of gaining empowerment?
I think it is using a traditional means of gaining empowerment, but it is also a very deep and affectionate way to reclaim attachment to land, to a social group from which you expect a certain kind of like support, respectability, and moral help in conditions of crisis. So those forms of entrustment that are very important in village life and especially among the poor become key, I think. I'm also showing in a book that, for example, age sets, which have been like this long theme in East African ethnology, the whole idea that, men get initiated who are born within a 15-year period, eventually get to be initiated into an age set, and the age set moves across different age grades throughout lifetime. And it's one age set is the Moran, the young warriors, who are incidentally the young men who are desirable in tourism. But then you move into elderhood, junior elderhood, senior elderhood, and so on. And a lot of the debate in this kind of early East Africanist anthropology was that with the capitalist market and its individualizing individualist ethos, age grades and age sets will eventually disappear. Well, what I'm seeing in Samburu is that what is happening is not that they disappear. To the contrary, they are becoming important in new ways, but they're also more animated by inequalities. So young men who do not go to the coast, or those who have gone to the coast and have been unsuccessful, find it very important to reassert those age set ties with their age mates, because those kinds of ties allow them to engage in all kinds of reciprocity, loans, debts, all kind of help. Whereas young men who do get a lot of wealth now dissociate themselves from their age sets, precisely not to have them constantly ask for money and dissipate their wealth, and oftentimes try to skip age sets by, age grades, by becoming elders before their time. Precisely because they have that money and they seek local respectability, it is through the age set system that that kind of respectability can be pursued.
Mm-hmm. And do these sort of communities, these age set communities, were they also present at the beachfront as well? Or was it a more capitalist individual pursuit of wealth at the beachfront?
Interestingly, the way in which historically, Samburu on the coast from the 1980s, actually 1979 was the first time when Samburu started migrating to the coast. And age sets and age grading hierarchy has been very important to how access to the beach economy has been structured among Samburu men themselves. So that with time, those who were elders were in charge of making sure that young men behave properly, that they're saving the money, that they're not wasting it on the coast. There was a whole system, actually, of taking daily attendance in the major towns where Samburu, there was a Samburu presence. All the young men had to be at a certain hour at a particular bar, and the elders would take attendance to make sure that everybody's okay. And in case somebody was arrested by police for walking without a permit, they would go and bail that person out. So the age sets, I think, were fundamental in importance. Also, on the coast, there were these kinds of self-help groups or welfare organizations that were often ethnicized. Kamba carvers, these carvers of the Kamba ethnic group had their own organization. Samburu had their own organizations. And these organizations were led by elders. They were oftentimes collecting the money that young men were making, putting it in a joint account. They could invest in all kinds of projects. And of late, while I was there, some of these elders were making sure that young men don't have access to their money until the day they're actually boarding a bus back to Samburu, to make sure that the money that they make on the coast gets invested in their home communities.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, and to that extent, I think that these kind of age set, age grade logics did play an important role, not only in belonging at home, but also in rerouting the money from the coast to home. At the same time, that the opposite is also the case. Young men find new modes of imagining their own identities on the coast. They suddenly see themselves as youth and find new possibilities of evading elders' control, as it were. So there were all these fights between elders and young men, one of which I document just at the beginning of the conclusion, mm-hmm. Where a young man swears at an elder after the elder is trying to scold him for disturbing the tourists. And then the age sets basically begin mobilizing against each other and fighting. And the chief of the dancing group says that on the coast, there is no difference between age sets, that we're all the same, and our purpose here is business. So stop arguing over who's an elder and who's a young man. And I thought of that moment very much, because that's where you see a certain kind of brand logic of ethnicity, mm-hmm. right? The very idea that what the Samburu are recognized for is this image of the young, erotic male warrior. You see a brand image articulating or coming into a certain kind of a contradiction with the logics of seniority that are otherwise so important for belonging.
Right. And would they stop anyone? When the money was collected within these age groups, it obviously could also be seen as a training ground and helping individuals. But was there any way to siphon that money back and perhaps go a different way? Because what I find is interesting is that they're moving away from traditional culture in such a way, creating this new capitalist economy based upon these tropes of traditional culture. But then why would they try to reintegrate as opposed to moving somewhere else?
Right. This was a key question that I had starting this project. Why, unlike other men in Kenya who are actually trying to find at the coast European partners precisely to move away, or even young women in relationships with Swiss, Italian men and so on, were seeking relationships in order to move to Europe, why these men were trying to move to otherwise marginal area of Kenya and invest in those kinds of relationships that might seem traditional, but what I'm arguing is that they're already so much inflected and have been so much inflected by the logics of commodity consumption, mm-hmm. by the logics of risk, that in a way the differentiation here between a capitalist and a traditional outside become themselves problematic. Although men themselves do see those as traditional, they do see them as somehow immutable and therefore also a guarantee of a certain kind of social value. And the answer that I could come up with was that precisely because of its political and economic marginalization, Samburu County, in Samburu County, money could be converted into forms of wealth that were perhaps much more visible, much more powerful than elsewhere. So to have a two-story house and a Land Rover in Nairobi, in a context in which you don't know many people, does not make the same kind of statement as it does in a Samburu village. Mm-hmm. In the savannah, where primarily what you have is like small mud houses and occasionally the wooden houses of labor migrants and so on. But that kind of visible convertibility of wealth was not enough in itself, because what I'm arguing is that money comes with a certain kind of history here, and people read that wealth and contested, associating it with witchcraft on the coast, associating it with a sex in which it originated, and therefore considering it highly polluted. So, for example, to think of feeding your parents or your children with money that you obtained from sex with tourists is something that many Samburus see as highly problematic, because it's circulating the logics of incest and adultery and pollution in all kinds of ways. So the question then became, how do you transform this money? It's not just that you bring the wealth to Samburu, but how do you convert it into something that is more durable, morally appropriate. And that, both on the coast and in Samburu, gave rise to all kinds of debates over what does it mean to belong in the first place? What does it mean to build a future? And what forms of social value are durable, a guarantee of a certain kind of growth, family growth and individual growth into the future? And which ones are only promising temporary pleasures? Mm-hmm.
And then speaking about the ceremonies and the rituals, could you speak a little bit about the Lopiro ceremony? Now, it seems from the book that this is a new thing that's just come up in the past few decades, but is there a history to this ceremony?
There absolutely is. I actually came upon the Lopiro ceremonies by accident. I didn't even know they exist. They weren't described anywhere in the literature, but they were very important at the time that they took place in 2010 and 2011. So basically what the ceremony Lopiro is a clan ceremony that mobilizes young married women against a younger age set of men who typically are said to have been their adulterous lovers. And what the ceremony is trying to do is reconcile those relationships by way of reasserting a certain kind of affective attachment to the clan. At the same time, some of the most spectacular moments in L'Opiro is when money is being recirculated. Money is gathered from the whole clan, and those men who were in relationships to European women had to donate the highest amount of money. But remember, I just said that kind of money is money of sex, mm-hmm. is money, polluted money, right? So why would you want it in a ritual that's trying to reenact a certain kind of morality and so on? And I'm arguing that it's precisely a certain kind of ritual money laundering here that we're seeing. That by recirculating that wealth to the clan, you reassert a certain kind of investment in local attachment, but you also cleanse that money by the kind of good gesture of sharing it with your clan mates. To get back to the question you were asking, there is a history to L'Opiro. Many of my informants said that the ceremony only started sometimes in the middle of the 20th century. However, looking into the component parts of the ceremony, one can see it even beyond that in other kinds of ceremonies that eventually were brought together and into what is today L'Opiro. But what is fascinating is that with every instantiation, this is a ceremony that only takes place every 15 years or so. With every instantiation, there is a certain kind of inflation in the kind of gifts that are being circulated. In the 60s or 70s, most of the gifts were about blankets, tobacco, soap. By the 1990s, people were exchanging bicycles, right? An idiom of a particular kind of masculinity, but because bicycles are primarily used by men, but also a certain kind of masculine mobility that is supposed to regenerate certain kinds of local attachments. And by 2010 and 11, when I studied them, clans were exchanging motorcycles on top of bicycles, and they were beginning already to plan to also purchase cars and pickup trucks as these kind of statements of collective power in the exchanges of L'Opiro. And how I read that kind of inflation is by dialectically looking at the statement that it makes against a certain within a broader space of the Kenyan state, in which the Samburu have long been marginalized, but that kind of marginalization has also taken place through logics of sexual alterity. The idea that because they're sexually different, because they're so backward, we're not going to invest in infrastructure, we're not going to invest in a local economy, and repositioning themselves by solving issues of adultery, improper sexuality in relation to this kind of imaginary of their sexual alterity, and also by mobilizing a certain kind of wealth to make a statement about political participation and political power to participate in a broader state arena.
Mm-hmm. And who brought about these ceremonies? Because the women felt as though they were very important for this cleansing. And so they would often stand in the stead of their missing sons. Is that correct?
Actually, no, that would be a separate ceremony. The women here are actually these mothers of Morans or young warriors, mm-hmm. are what I call them, the fire stick elders' wives. It's women at the kind of peak of their political career are very important in these ceremonies, and they are the ones initiating the ceremony, oftentimes by resisting the kind of opposition of their husbands. So they are really very much invested in them, precisely because it is also a fertility ceremony. L'Opéra promises to restore the fertility of women who can still give birth and have a lot of stake in growing their lineages. Mm. Yeah.
Wow. Sorry, go ahead.
So the what you mentioned, though, about mothers replacing sons is a different kind of ceremony. It was also taking place in the villages where I work, but it's on a smaller scale. And that was trying to deal, it's called a Mayan, and it basically means a blessing. And it was trying to deal with the fact that over the past decade, more and more young men were actually fighting, physically fighting with elders. And that raised all kinds of questions about the authority of elders and the disrespect of young men and so on. So this Mayan was meant to kind of restore those relationships so that elders would not curse young men with death. And when the ceremonies were taking place and so much energy was invested in them, some of the men who are on the coast working in tourism, because it was the peak of the season tourists, and here like the Samburu calendar of propitious time, which is basically following the moon, is conflicting with the peak tourist seasons on the coast. Many of the men did not return home. So I'm describing how some of their kin, including their mothers, would take their calabashes, the kind of wooden containers in which they would drink milk, to replace them in this ceremony, to take on the blessings for them. In that case, devising new kinds of ways of incorporating absent men into the local ties of belonging.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's really interesting. It's very fascinating how the importance of ritual within the society.
I think that's precisely the point that I'm trying to make here. It's not that we're talking about a place, a community in which ritual is important, period, but rather the fact that what ritual means and what ritual does at different times is itself a historical question, and that these kinds of ritual economies themselves get intensified in particular contexts in which they become meaningful politically, by way of imagining a collective future, by way of imagining a relationship to the state, and so on. So that whole opposition that we typically have what's traditional place that deals with ritual and modern places that deal with consumption and other things is itself a very problematic assumption. Ritual is modern through and through. Of course, it has a long history, but it is also a political means for envisioning futures in the present.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. Thank you so much for talking about this. I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but I would like to ask you about what your next project is.
Sure. I'm currently working on a book that is tentatively entitled Rescuing Sex, Intimacy and the Moral Rehabilitation of Citizenship in Kenya. And the key idiom that is at the core of this book is the idiom of rescue, that is different kinds of calls to save intimacy from, say, the corrupting forces of contemporary life and to secure it as a condition of collective vitality and prosperity. And what drove me to this project were certainly the current debates about sexuality in East Africa, and many of our listeners will be familiar with the kind of panics that emerged around homosexuality in many African countries. And Uganda has been probably one of the most mediatized cases, but certainly Kenya is right in that area. And I'm trying to think about how humanitarian ideologies of rescue have been have been permeating people's self-understanding of their own attachments to the state and to each other. So that I've been working again on the coast, but also in Nairobi and also in Samburu with different people who now understand their gestures of helping others in terms of rescue. For example, you have sex workers on the coast who would intervene in a situation in which one of them is being beaten by a customer, or in which a child is being ignored by a mother, and so on, and would understand what they're doing as rescue. Even in Swahili, they would say tunafanya kazi ya rescue, that is, we do the work of rescue. And what I'm trying to understand is how this ethos of rescue emerges, and how does it become an important site from which to understand the relationship between sexuality and citizenship and sociality in Kenya today? But the way I get to it is by trying to look at different kind of objects around which a certain kind of rescue ethos becomes available. One of which is plastic in Samburu, where a lot of kind of panics around plastic and how plastic might pollute not only the environment, but also bodies, also kinship, and so on, has to do with the fact that plastic is a non-self-reproducing material and a polluting, a foreign polluting material at once, which in a way, like quote-unquote homosexuality in these kinds of discourses, is polluting the nation from the outside. And there are other kinds of objects I'm looking at, like diapers and beads and the figure of the terrorists. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to imagine a book around this kind of what I call queer objects that allow us to tap into sexuality from domains that are not immediately recognizable as the domains of the sexual. Mm-hmm. So I'm taking kind of Foucault's idea of sex being a fictive unity seriously, and trying to see what are the other places from which understanding sexuality and sexual citizenship becomes possible.
Oh, well, that sounds fascinating. I look forward to reading it when it comes out.
Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you so much for joining us today. Again, this is George Paul Mayhew, and he has written the book Ethnoerotic Economies, Sexuality, Money, and Belonging in Kenya. And it was published by University of Chicago Press in 2017. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Erin. It was a pleasure talking to you and our listeners.